It's the history of football we knows about, and we want to expand what we know. We'll become such intelligent gentry with every kick to kick show. Beginning in the time 1870s, right through to the modern day. Tune in for Timmy Coops and the Kazman to hear what they all have to say. That's
it. Hi guys, Tim from the Kick to Kick podcast here. We recently released the 1922 episode of our podcast, in which we had an interview with Robert Allen about his Kazaley the Legend book. In that episode, we had to cut out quite a bit of our conversation with Robert. So what we've released here is the conversation in full. It goes for about an hour. We chopped it to make sure it fitted into our podcast, but we thought it was really worth everyone having a listen to. So here is the Robert Allen, Roy Kazaley interview in full. Enjoy. Welcome to the show, Robert Allen.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, whenever we interview people, we like to get a feel for who they support and why. So first question we have for you is, what team do you support?
Oh, well, for my troubles, I grew up following Carlton.
Carlton.
So I guess I'm still with them, though it's hard at times. Yeah, I grew up in Canberra, and the funny thing about Canberra in the 70s, it didn't have any teams of its own, you know, soccer or league or obviously not AFL. So, and most people that lived in Canberra came from either Sydney or Melbourne. So all of my friends either followed league or they followed the then BFL as it was. Anyway, I just picked Carlton, and that's been my team.
So there was no reason why you went for Carlton?
Oh, well, it was probably a bit selfish. I think they were going pretty well.
Yeah. Of course, yeah.
It makes sense.
I think when you're a kid, you tend to latch onto a team that looks pretty successful.
Yeah,
I think that
probably
was
right.
The case with me with Carlton. I found out later on that I was distantly related to David Glasgow, the winger. That wasn't an influence at the time.
So, what number did you have in your jumper as a kid?
Oh, I didn't have a number, but I can tell you, I can probably preempt your next question. The best game I ever saw Carlton play,
yes,
was in 1988. I was studying at Queensland Uni, and it was midway through the season, and my friend at uni, who was a mad Collingwood supporter, said to me after exams, "Oh, you know, Carlton's playing Collingwood at the G this weekend." So, being poor students back then, you didn't really fly. So we jumped on a bus, and 22 hours later, we're in Melbourne, and we went to see Carlton play Collingwood. And great game. It was a huge crowd there. I think well into it. It was 80 something thousand. And anyway, Collingwood did win that game in time on, but it was that classic game where Silvani took that screamer over Stasevich.
Yeah.
Which I think ended up being Mark of the Year that year in 1988. So I was pleased I was able to see that Mark live. And Silvani was always one of my favourite players around that time. So, and the next day I went into the Herald Sun and bought a copy of the photo and took it home. And yeah, so that was pretty memorable.
But better was, with a 44-hour return trip to watch the game? It's not
well,
bad.
We enjoyed the game so much, we decided to stay down for another week.
Oh, good,
and,
yeah. Make the most of it.
We were staying with his aunt at, where did they live? Sandringham, I think. Oh. And anyway, the next week, I went and saw Carlton play St Kilda in the mud at Moorabbin.
Yeah.
And it was one of those typical wet, muddy days. And I thought for a while I must have dreamt it, but I've had it verified since that at three-quarter time, Baldock came onto the field wearing gumboots. to address the players. And I thought for years afterwards I must have dreamt that. But I've had it verified by a couple of mad St Kilda historians that no, it's true that he would on occasion wear his gumboots out into the field.
That's fantastic.
So I was lucky to see that too.
Now, you live up in Queensland, don't you? Is it Brisbane?
Yes, that's right, Brisbane.
Do you get to the football match up there?
I do on occasion, yes. Since I had kids, I don't go to the footy as much as I used to. I still like going to a game. And it's good. And we're very lucky to have not one but two teams up here.
Yeah.
Good. And so no more 22-hour bus rides. You can just go to the Gabba.
No. That's right. That's right. After Canberra, I lived in Tassie for a number of years, and I used to go and watch the footy regularly at North Hobart on a Saturday afternoon. That was good fun.
That would have been fantastic, and a very strong league as well.
Yes, very strong league. Very strong league. And some great players.
Yeah.
So let's get to this book. So in 2017, you released a book called Kazaly the Legend. We have read, which is a really good read.
Oh, fantastic.
To start with, what inspired you to write this book?
Well, I've always loved footy and footy history. And I mean, you guys know there's some great stories. It goes back generations.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and so I'd written a few sort of smaller pieces for things like the Footy Record about sort of interesting or quirky things that had happened in footy over time. And that was hard to do. That was sort of hard to break into because it's very much a Melbourne footy mafia, really.
Yeah.
So really, you've got to have something interesting or something no one's seen or heard before to sort of get their attention.
Yeah.
And I was lucky. Occasionally, I'd come across a story and I'd pitch it, and to their credit, they were prepared to publish stuff from something, you know, they'd never heard of before. But I also mentioned about living in Tassie for a number of years, and I came across the fact that Roy Kazaly had played and coached a lot of his career in Tassie, both in Launceston and in Hobart, to some good success. And I thought, oh, look, it'd be interesting to look at that part of his career. And so I wrote a piece for a Tasmanian magazine called 40 Degrees South. And in the course of researching that, I spoke to a couple of Roy's grandkids, because almost all of his descendants still live in Tassie to this day. And after the piece was published, we had a chat, and I said to some of the relatives, look, you know, there's a bigger story here. It'd be lovely to write his whole story, because for them, the grandkids, they grew up in the 40s, 50s, 60s, knowing him very well after his playing and coaching days. But he died in 63, so he's been gone quite a while.
Yeah.
And their kids never got to know him. So we thought, look, it'd be nice to do the story about his whole story. Really, it was just to start with for them and for their kids to know more about him. And then I thought, well, look, there might be a broader audience more interested in the story as well. So I approached Jeff Slattery, who's a well-known journo and publisher in Melbourne. And to his credit, he said, yeah, he said, I think we should have books about some of these legends of the game. And it started from there, and it was some years ago. It was a real labour of love. It took me ages to research and write it, but I learned more as I went.
No, it's ridiculous.
It mentioned in there that, yeah, you've been doing the research for almost a decade. Is that right?
that's true. I'm a bit ashamed to say.
No.
but you know, you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah, absolutely.
These projects. And you know, you tell yourself, oh, this is... Well, at first I thought, the analogy I thought was, it was a bit like putting a jigsaw puzzle together.
Yeah.
And so you start with the outside bits. Okay, you start with what we know, what was on the public record. And that was easy enough to find. And then you start delving into more of the detail and you fill in the inside bits. But then I eventually realised that it's not, writing a biography is not like putting a jigsaw together, because there's no one predetermined picture at the end.
No.
There's no starting point. There's no ending point where you put the last piece in and, oh, they're finished. it can be as long or as short as you like. And 100 biographers will write 100 different biographies.
Yeah.
So in the end, you've just got to get a bit disciplined, which is what I did. And my publisher was very tolerant. but eventually we started saying, okay, right, well, this is the date we're going to have a draft done. And once we started firming up dates about final drafts and editing and layout and stuff, it actually came together fairly quickly, actually, towards the end.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, because you would have had it all there in your head ready to go, and then as soon as you start writing, it's just
you don't know exactly where it's going to go once you start.
No.
And it's only after doing a fair bit of research that you get in your mind some of the themes that eventually come out. And also too, you set the bar, I think, fairly high for yourself. When you write a few chapters and you're happy with them, you want to make sure that the next chapters you write sort of maintain that standard. You don't want to drop off.
Yeah, of course.
And you don't want to skim over bits. And if you find bits that are important to his life, you really got to do him justice. And so sometimes that means things like getting a crash course in what were the coaching techniques used for rowers, you know, yeah, years ago, or what caused the polio outbreak in Melbourne in the 30s, and why was it so severe, and why was it that some footy clubs kept playing during the war and others didn't?
Yeah.
So you find yourself going down rabbit holes, I guess.
Yeah, it's not
because to me it's all about context.
Yeah, not purely about the man, but all the things that happened around him. Yeah, of course.
No, that's right. You could probably write a computer program these days that could write a biography based on Google and, you know, Trove,
yeah,
the National Library's newspaper digitization program, but it wouldn't give you that context.
No, of course.
And that's really what you want, because to me, you want to know what made that person, or try and find out anyway, what made that person tick.
Yeah, and that was something that I found especially fascinating about the book. I was saying to the guys before, I'm a Melbourne supporter, but I live in South Melbourne and have for about a decade, and I loved the history of the suburb and everything that you talked about Albert Park and Port Melbourne and all the different things that were going on with the industry and, you know, through to the Depression and all those things. I found that absolutely fascinating as well, and it does give a huge insight into the person who he was outside of football as well.
Yes. Well, look, you know, those clubs were part and parcel of their local community.
Yeah.
I mean, kids went to school, you know, and they lived down the road from players. Their dads might have worked with them in the local factories.
Yeah.
You know, they were the movie stars of the day.
Yeah.
And when you do things like, and one of the things I was really pleased to come across during the research was I found the original minutes book for the South Melbourne Footy Club between 1921 and 24, and it was in a bookshop in Sydney, if all
places.
Oh, wow. And this guy that owned it kindly let me go in and do a recce one day, and I spent the whole day in this bookshop poring over these minutes and making meticulous notes, and I wrote a report on it for the Swan. And to their credit, they got one of their benefactors in Sydney from one of their coterie groups actually bought the book, so it's now back with the club where it should always have been.
Yeah.
But you read that and you really get a sense of a footy club as part and parcel of a community, and, you know, the trainers were often there for 20-30 years. They were often former players. The officials were former players. The president was usually the local mayor, or someone who owned the local factory or the local brewery, and so they could sling someone a job when they wanted to try and encourage someone to join their team. You know, the head trainer, when they'd used up the footies were worn out, they'd give them to the local boys' sides, and it was just, you know, part and parcel, as I say, of that community.
Yeah.
So getting to Cazaly then, what fascinates you about Roy Cazaly?
I guess if you were to sum him up, his approach to footy was he was a professional in an amateur era.
Mm.
He was, and I guess Bradman is someone you could say was pretty similar, had this single-minded resolve to learn and play the game and coach the game as best he could, to look for every single advantage he could find that he could use on the field against his opponent. He would look, I guess, for what one day, these days, we'd call the one percenters. And for him, it was keeping fit. It was a very strict diet. It was paying extraordinary attention to his gear, the footy gear, particularly his boots. And it was just those little things that he'd look for. It was trying to get in the mind of his opponents as well. So I guess he would have studied their form as well. And I know that he used that to great effect when he was coaching. He'd take players aside and he'd talk particularly about who their direct opponent was and what they should do. He would tell players, you know, when you're on the field, if the ball's up the other end, I want you to think about what you're going to do if the ball starts coming towards you. You know, he was always thinking, he was always looking for that advantage. And even in later life, you know, when the game was changing, it was speeding up a lot, the rules were changing, he thought that was great, because he really thought that an ideal game was one where his players would use initiative, and skill to continue to play on. He encouraged his players to play on at all costs. And he often had young junior sides. And he used to like coaching young blokes because he said they basically had no fear. They were prepared to take risks. And that's what he liked about coaching, was encouraging them to take those risks and play on.
Yeah. And so at the end of the book, you included a lot of his quotes and the advice he gave to players. And as you just said, it really does suggest that he was ahead of his time.
Yeah, he was a thinker. He could be fire and brimstone when he wanted to be. But I think he also realised that different players responded to different stimuli. And some of them performed better and responded better when you took them aside and just had a quiet chat with them. And so he would do that. There was one guy I quoted in the book. It was a great player from Tassie, a fellow called Rex Garwood. Now, he spent most of his first senior season at Newtown in Hobart sitting on the bench, just listening to what Cazaly did and the instructions he was, he was giving to his team and the talks he gave them and that sort of stuff. He learned a lot of stuff just from sitting next to him. And a lot of players basically, I think, saw him as a de facto father in a lot of ways, because he took a genuine interest in people. The funny thing is, he didn't drink himself, but he wasn't a wowser. He didn't mind other players having a drink, as long as they did it after a game and not during the week. And there was one time when he was coaching Newtown, when he heard that his star full forward had actually been in a pub, seen sighted in a pub, I think on a Wednesday before the game. And even though this player protested he actually hadn't had a drink, the fact is he'd been at the pub when he was told they weren't allowed to be, and he was dropped that week. Because Ali thought, well, these are the rules, and but I'm going to have to make an example of it.
Yeah, you've got to stick with them. He was a huge proponent for, as you said, a lot of things that were ahead. I know he was talking about unlimited interchanges at some stage, and when the VFA brought in that throw pass, he was wanting them to bring it into the VFL as well. So he was...
Yeah, no, he loved it. He loved it. He thought it was great. As I said before, it really did speed up the game.
Yeah.
And he certainly thought it was worth bringing in. So he wasn't a traditionalist too much in that sense. I mean, even way back in I think it was 1919, when he was playing St Kilda, he was interviewed by someone for the Herald. And he told the reporter he thought there were too many goals being scored. It's pretty funny coming from a goal kicker.
Yeah, exactly.
But he reckoned that they should do away with point posts. So forget about points. We'll only count goals. And we'll put a crossbar
across the
remaining. So basically turn it into a hybrid version of rugby. and goals would only count if they went over the post on the way through. So, he was a thinker even back then.
Do you think that came from the fact that he was, he had such a big tank? Before we even think about players ever running out a whole game, I mean, that way he was able to breathe and he was always light-footed and he followed the ball an entire game. He saw that as that was the ideal. You should be able to chase a ball for the whole four quarters, and the guys who can do that should reap the rewards.
Yeah, I think you're right. He was... amazingly fit. I mean, he used to... Well, you mentioned before about growing up at Albert Park. The great advantage for him was he grew up in a household with 10 kids, a pretty poor family.
Yeah.
They would have just been so cramped. But he had Albert Park next door. And when he went to St Kilda, he would train by literally running and dodging.
Yeah.
Running at trees and just dodging past them at the last
minute.
Isn't
that amazing? Yeah.
His rowing would have been very good for that fitness as well, and he learned a lot about fitness and teamwork.
Yeah,
and diet from his dad.
I love that.
Been a champion rower.
Yeah, I love that. In the book, that line about there's not in a cricket team, you can show yourself as an individual champion even though you're part of a team. As a footballer, of course, you can. As a rower, no one looks at you as an individual rower. It is all part of the team. And he obviously took that, as you said before, coalescence of the team was so important to him. And he obviously took that into football from the rowing.
That's right. I mean, you are literally a number. aren't you?
Yeah.
When you think about it, I mean, people talk about in an eight, you know, the number six and the number seven, and okay, a stroke's important and the cox is important, but no one's more important than anybody else.
Yeah.
And unless you row as a team, well, you're not going to have much success. And he was a very good, he was a very good rower. And the problem that he found, well, publicly he said the reason he eventually stopped rowing was because the season overlapped with his footy training. But in reality, what happened was that the rowing club had written to St Kilda saying, well, hang on, what's his actual status? Is he a professional or is he an amateur?
Yeah.
Because rowing was very... Well, you could row as a professional, but it meant that you rowed in your own specific regattas and specific races. You were either someone who rowed for a living,
or you were
someone, you know, one of those labourers who had a natural advantage.
Yeah.
or you were a gentleman scholar who rowed for fun, you know, and not for the prize. And they were very strict about which category you were in, depending on what you did. And once they found out he was being actually paid to play footy, as he would have been by then at St Kilda, you know, he wouldn't, his days of a rowing amateur would have been numbered.
And that's, yeah, and obviously he wanted to stay as part of that club and wasn't going to move into professional rowing, yeah.
No, no, that's right. By then, of course, he'd got married, he was starting to have kids, and, you know, he would have been earning pretty good money and thinking, well, this is the way I'm going to go. And he would have seen his dad, who had rowed as an amateur for a lot of his life, but also rowed on the side for prize money. His dad ended up pretty poor and broken as a night watchman. And I guess he figured he didn't really want to end up like that if he could help it.
Yeah.
So let's get to the phrase up there, Kazaley, because for a lot of the younger generation, they kind of only know Kazaley from that, the up there, Kazaley,
Mike Brady
song.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
But there's much more to it than that. Can you kind of explain how big that term was?
Yeah, well, it came about by accident. He'd spent the best part of a decade at St Kilda,
and
where he'd
thing,
been a pretty good player, but in a pretty ordinary team.
Yeah.
You guys know they didn't have many highlights. Because the 1913 Grand Final would have been fantastic, but sadly they lost that one, and that was their last hurrah for probably 50 years.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of infighting at St Kilda too.
Yeah.
And I mentioned before about how he used to practice by running at trees. Well, his mentor at that time was a fellow called Billy Schmidt, and I know you guys have talked about him. He was a bit of a larger than life, but also a divisive character. Schmidt had come over from Richmond. But he had a habit of falling out with officials and his fellow team members. And by 1920, I think he tried to apply to go back to Richmond again, and it had been blocked.
The club had approved it, and the VFL were the ones who actually blocked it.
Right, probably on grounds of where he lived or something like that, because by then they'd brought in the zone system.
Yeah.
And ironically, it was the zone system that meant that when Roy finally got fed up with what was happening at St Kilda, and he had applied numerous times to transfer to Carlton. Carlton had been his boyhood team, and he wanted to go and play with them. Anyway, when they finally let him go, the new zone rules meant that he had to go and play with South Melbourne.
Yeah.
And so it was South Melbourne where he formed this ruck trio with son of German immigrants, a guy called Freddie Flyder, and a really nippy rover called Mark Tandy. And they teamed up in the ruck in 1921. And they were at their height of their powers probably for the next two seasons or so. Yeah. And they really captured the public imagination. And South itself wasn't going really strong as a team, but their ruck was just... you know, almost unbeatable.
Yeah.
And the up there Kazaley started because when the ball was in the air heading towards a pack, Freddie Flyder would often yell out, if it was a long ball, it was one for Kazaley to go for. And so he'd say, up there Kazaley, or up there Kazaley. And all we can surmise is that the crowds at the Lake Oval around the boundary line heard him say this, and they picked it up too. So when the ball was in the air and Kazaley was anywhere near it, then the cry would go up, and it caught on. And it was just one of those phrases that ended up going into the common language, into the vernacular. And it really took off, and it was big through the 30s. It went with Victorian soldiers overseas during the war.
Yeah, it was incredible.
I mean, some have written, some like Peter Fitzsimons have written that it would, that it became almost a war cry.
Yeah.
During battle, but I think that's overstating it. I mean, the infantry battalions had their own war cries, and that wasn't one of the official ones. I just think that it was a saying that they'd used before the war, and it was one of those interchangeable terms as well, cry of encouragement or elation, or, you know, a laconic sort of saying. And they just used it in places like Tobruk and Kokoda, as they had used it before the war. And they brought it back with them. And then it was sort of, I think it's fair to say the phrase was dying out in the 50s because the generation that had used it was dying out.
Yeah.
Then, you know, a play, The Summer of the 17th Doll by Ray Lawler, who thankfully is still with us. He's in his 90s. In fact, I think he lives in Elwood from memory.
Oh.
He wrote this play. And at the time he wrote the play, which was in the mid 50s, he himself was working in factories during the week alongside Footscray players, and trying to become a playwright, which is what he wanted to be. And he used the language of the streets and the pubs in his play. It was the first really quintessentially Australian play where he had Australian... Before then, people were used to going to the theatre and they'd see English actors or they'd see American actors. Mm. It was a play that had Australian themes and Australian actors. And so that helped revive the phrase because a barmaid uses the phrase in his play a couple of times. And then there's all these other little side shoots of the story that are fascinating. Like, I think the fact that Laurence Olivier took the play to London, to West End, and while it was playing there, a fellow called John Clark, not the late comic, but John Clark, who was a drama teacher originally from Hobart, went and saw the play and thought, oh, geez, there's something happening in the theatre industry back in Australia. John went back to Australia and helped establish NIDA.
Oh, wow.
You know, and all these years later, you know, he helped, you know, the development of careers like Russell Crowe, for example, and Mel Gibson. And Kate Blanchett and all these others, but he still says his proudest moment was back in uni days when he kicked a footy with Roy Cazale. So, and then of course in 79, Mike Brady was asked to write a jingle essentially for Channel 7's footy show, and the previous year of course had seen Come On Aussie, Come On for the cricket, and that had been enormously successful, and they wanted something similar, and Brady, who himself was a very accomplished musician and a jingle writer, remembered two things. One was a nun at his school in Port Melbourne when he literally just got off the boat, I think in 53. He'd come over his family were 10-pound poms. They'd come over on the boat. The first day at school, someone had asked him, the bully put him in a headlock and asked him who he supported, and someone whispered to him, tell him Collingwood, so he did. So that was his team. But he remembered a nun used to sing out up there, Kazali, when they'd kick a footy round in the schoolyard. And coincidentally, he'd also seen a televised version of The Summer of the 17th Doll just a few days earlier.
Oh, wow.
So he remembered those two things. And the irony, of course, as he freely admits, is he didn't know who this Kazali was.
Yeah.
Other than the saying sounded like a good hook for a song. So he wrote the song in 20 minutes, and of course it was just a theme song, and all these people rang up Channel 7 switchboard and said, oh, where can I buy the single? And it wasn't a single. So him and his collaborator, I think it was Mike Sullivan, Peter Sullivan, went back in the studio, did a 3-minute version of the song, and it became the highest selling single of all time to that point in Australia. It went past Slim Dusty's Pub with No Beer.
Oh my God.
And within 3 months, he was asked to sing it at the 79 Grand Final.
That's amazing. And now we wheel him out every Grand Final. So
exactly. I mean... And the funny thing is, for a long time, he didn't really get on that well with the then VFL. Well, firstly, because he had the temerity to ask for a fee when he first sang it, and they couldn't get over that. Why would he want to get paid when he was getting all this free publicity? But secondly, I think because they didn't actually own the song themselves. And so they had this sort of love-hate relationship, I think, with Brady for a number of years. And then probably the best thing they could have done was a few years ago, I think it was the Herald, asked the AFL why they weren't including Upbeck Bazzali in their grand final broadcast anymore. And the response was, well, you know, we did some research, and we found that people were a bit sick of it.
But no, he's definitely there every grand finalist, and it's great that his name is kind of etched in every grand final now because we get to hear that song.
And this year, of course, is the 40th anniversary of the song.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah. And, of course, the big irony, I think, one of the lovely ironies about the song is that, and I talked before about Kazali being the innovator, in the late 50s, I think it was 58, him and his wife Aggie got on a boat and they went to England for their first and only trip abroad, as you did in those days. You couldn't really, most people couldn't afford to fly.
Yeah.
And so you got on the boat for 3 months. Anyway, while they were in London, he went to an FA Cup final. And anyway, when he came back to Australia, they were met on the docks in Melbourne by some journos, and someone said, well, did you see any sport while you're over there, Roy? And what did you think? And he said, oh, well, I went to an FA Cup final. It was a great atmosphere. He said, I still think our game has it all over theirs when it comes to spectacle. He said, but one thing I really liked, he says, before the match, they all stood up and sang Abide With Me.
Yep.
You know, that famous hymn. And ironically, it was and sort of poignantly, it was the same year as the, remember the Munich air disaster? Where a number of players from, you'll have to remind me which
Manchester
team it was.
United, I
Manchester?
Think it was. Yeah.
Yeah. Died, and it was that year. So it had an added poignancy at that cup final when they sang it. Anyway, so Roy said, I think we've got everything we need, but what we really need is a hymn, some sort of song we can sing before a grand final. And I just think it's ironic that all those years later...
It's about him.
Brady came up with a, albeit secular song, that's about him. Yeah.
Isn't that fantastic?
But it's not really just about him. It's about footy, isn't it?
Yeah.
Footy in general. Yeah. So, yeah, it's a lovely... It's almost like the way Aboriginal people talk about song lines.
Yeah.
It's just interesting when you read the history and you follow it through, because it's, you know, it's almost 100 years now since that saying came into being.
Yeah, yes. You're right.
So
Roy Kazali played at South Melbourne and St Kilda, and then he was a coach at Hawthorn, and obviously our podcast, we talk about mainly the VFL, although we'd like to talk about other things as well, but of those clubs, where do you think he had the biggest impact?
I think playing-wise, certainly South Melbourne. I said before that his career literally took off when he went to South Melbourne.
Yeah.
And there was a couple of things that I think helped that in the public mind. And one was that the crowds were really surging after the war.
Yeah.
They started setting some real big crowd numbers. We're going to games. And just as importantly, I think it was 1921 was the birth of the Sporting Globe.
Yep.
Great paper, you know, the pink paper. And the thing about the Sporting Globe is it came out twice a week. So on the Wednesday, you had all the sort of, the reviews of the previous weekend and looking forward to the next weekend. You had lots of columns written by current and former players and lots of photos as well. And player profiles, which are quite detailed. You know, that often focus on, say, three players over a full foolscap page.
Yep.
And that have photos of the player, often at training, in action or whatever, and then a detailed profile. And then on a Saturday, they were able to phone the scores in from the different grounds and then rush out a Saturday night edition, which you could buy within a couple of hours of the end of the game. So people going home would buy it, or they'd walk down to the newsagent, buy the paper
technology
to get the scores. And I think that really helped develop players' profiles in the minds. I mean, I said before that players were famous in their own suburbs. I think things like the Sporting Globe helped them become famous, you know, across all of Melbourne.
Yeah. Yeah, because you didn't actually have to be at every game to hear what players are doing.
Yep, that's right. And you could follow them, and they were getting better at reporting the stats and that sort of thing. So I think he was probably most influential as a player when he was at South Melbourne. As a coach, well, Hawthorn... And it was hard, you know. It was during the war. Every club struggled with trying to put a team on the field every week because so many of their players had signed up and they were in the armed services. So they might be off training or they might be sent overseas at very short notice. Lots of turnover in players, lots of debutants. So, you know, I think if you jagged a grand final win during World War II, you were probably just maybe a bit luckier than some of the other clubs.
Yeah.
His main contribution to Hawthorn, well, in his first year there in 42, they beat Collingwood for the first time ever.
Yeah.
So that was at Victoria Park. I mean, they'd been in the comp since 25, of course, and they hadn't gone too well in most of that time. But his big contribution in terms of, I guess, morale came the following year when he changed the name from the Maybellines to the Hawks.
Yeah, that's amazing, isn't it? I love that. I mean, you can understand it. I mean, Maybellines, as a D supporter coming from the Fuchsias, there's not a lot of power in these flower names, is there?
No, there's not.
Right.
There's not. You know, they might be poetic, but they don't do much to fire up the blood. I think it wouldn't have been long before they would have found another name anyway.
Yeah.
But that one just matched.
Yeah.
And what I think is lovely about that story is it was his daughter Patricia who swears black and blue, swore till the day she died that it was her that suggested the name around the kitchen table one day early in that season. And what I love about it too, and being the war, things just happened, you know, because they had to happen. So it was just Roy, I think, spoke to a few of the players, and then he went to the club meeting the next night, and it was just, and it's there in the minutes, the Hawthorn minutes, general business, not special item or anything like that, just general business. Coach Cazale announced he'd changed the name of the team from the Maybellines to the Hawks. There was no vote, no discussion. Only business arising, they asked the secretary to acquire a couple of stuffed Hawks
to put
in the committee room. And they're still there. One of them, at least, is still there. I'm sure you've probably seen the Hawks Great Museum out at Waverley.
Not yet, actually.
Oh, you've got to go. Great museum.
We haven't started talking about the Hawks yet because they're not in the league.
Oh, of course they're not in the league. Well, when you get to 25, maybe you should go out and do a show. Do a record out there with someone from the museum. It's really worth a look. So that's where one of the Hawks ended up. So I guess that was his biggest contribution to all the two things he contributed there. I think it's fair to say that his best coaching legacy came in Tassie.
Yes.
I mentioned before he went to Tassie, and he went a number of times. I think he probably would have first gone there for the 24 National Carnival.
Yep.
Where he played a very strong role in Victoria winning that championship. And I guess he just really enjoyed the place because a few years later, he went back and he coached a team in Launceston called City.
Yep.
And his big find, he coached them to two local premierships and two state premierships.
Isn't that amazing?
Tassie's funny. There's this historical rivalry between North and South, and of course extended to footy. Before he'd got there, the North very rarely beat the South. But while he was there, his team City won the state premiership. So that was bragging rights basically to the best team in Tassie.
Yeah.
Won it twice. And they liked him so much, they appointed him coach of the Northern team. So every year, the North would take on the South.
Yep.
And so he had some good wins there. His biggest find, I think, when he was at City was he gave Laurie Nash his first game.
Yeah.
And, of course, went on to become a champion player with South Melbourne.
Well, quite a few players he coached ended up playing in the VFL, didn't they?
Colin Watson. The story goes that he discovered Colin Watson when he was down coaching in Warrnambool at the end of 1919 when St Kilda, as usual, hadn't made the finals. and he went down there just to do a bit of coaching and discovered this technical college student called Colin Watson and encouraged him to apply at St Kilda. Of course, they gave him a run. He had a couple of false starts. He got homesick, went home a couple of times, but of course he ended up winning a Brownlow medal. And also too, when he coached country, he would often put people different clubs' way. When he was coaching in Minyip, for example, he discovered a guy called Eric Zeski.
Yes.
And Zeski being the son of that was a lot of Lutheran farmers in that area. Anyway, he encouraged Zeski to go down to Melbourne, and of course he ended up playing a number of years with Richmond during the 30s. So yeah, he did discover quite a few along the way. But as well as Launceston, he also coached in Hobart, and he coached North Hobart to a premiership. He coached Newtown to two premierships. And then he went back to Melbourne, did some more VFA coaching, coached Hawthorn, as you say. Oh, he coached Swans, of course, 37-38. Not very successful year, sadly. The nice thing about that period was he actually... South were going so bad that he actually mused publicly that perhaps he might do some good if he took the field.
Yeah.
And, of course, these are the days before runners and coaches weren't allowed on the field at any time, this sort of stuff. So he thought, well, maybe the best role I can be is to be a playing coach. Maybe I can go on the field. And here's a guy who's in his 40s talking about going back and playing VFL. Anyway, the committee said no. They slapped him down. But in 1939... he stepped down from coaching the firsts and he coached the seconds. And it was at the time when his son, Roy Jr., was coming up as well. So the lovely thing about that year was that Roy Sr. and Roy Jr. played a number of games together on the forward line for South Melbourne seconds.
Isn't that fantastic?
During 39. And, of course, the sad thing was in August, war broke out.
Yep.
His son was in the Navy reserve, and so he got called up straight away.
Yeah.
So his promising career was cut short, truncated by 6 years, because they hardly saw him for the next 6 years while he was away with the Navy. He had quite a good career though in Hobart after the war, but he lost a bit of time during the war. But as I said, I think he was able to take and learn and apply everything he'd learnt playing and coaching, and importantly, what he learnt from the club doctors when he was at St Kilda and South Melbourne, and he applied that to his coaching in Tassie.
Yeah.
And I guess for many teams, these were revolutionary tactics, and he was able to apply them to good effect and won a number of premierships. And in fact, he's the coach of the Tassie team of the century because of his strike rate in Tassie during the 20s, 30s and 40s with teams down there.
Would you say Kazaley was a better coach than player?
Hard to know. I'm not sure how you'd compare them. I mean, they do say a lot of players make lousy coaches.
Yeah.
There's plenty of examples like that in history. I think when he was successful, it was when he got the team to perform as a team. I think when he got the team to play as he would have liked to have played himself. There were plenty of times in his career where he might have been, say, at South or St Kilda, part of a very successful ruck, but the rest of the team weren't pulling together. And I guess he would have been frustrated by that. And when the teams were going well, he would have thought to himself, right, well, that's what makes good success. And he was happiest when he had a young team, a team of kids with really nothing to prove, and not having those old-fashioned habits that he might have to knock out of them. There's lots of reports about he'd do these famous blackboard lectures where he'd demonstrate on a blackboard the field positions and the tactics, and he would get a room, in awe for a good hour while he demonstrated this. And I think that's where he got the best out of teams, was when he could get them to see the value of, working together, showing initiative, but also remembering, you've got teammates alongside you as well.
Absolutely.
So I guess that one of the last things was, so in 25, when he was playing and had won, three best and fairest at that stage and was really at the height of his powers, he packed up and moved to country to captain Coach Minyip. So why do you think he did that?
I think he probably knew that he wasn't going to keep being able to play VFL at the top level forever. I'm sure money was a factor.
Yeah.
I mean, money never meant a lot to him, except I guess when he needed it, when his kids were growing up, he had a family to support. The thing about the Minyip job was there was big money in the Wimmer at the time. Wheat was fetching record prices. The clubs were cashed up, and often they would apply. They would advertise, hoping to lure a good player from Melbourne to take on the team and be captain coach. The rivalries against the neighbouring districts were really strong. A lot of pride was on the line. His mate, I mentioned before, from Richmond, who was his name again?
Billy Schmidt.
I'll remember it. Schmidt, that's right, Schmidt. had become the first playing coach of a Minyip team a few years earlier.
Oh, okay.
And back then, and I think that was in about 1920 when he'd gone to Minyip, he'd gone to Warratnabil. The reason he was able to do it was because the local competition was a Wednesday comp. So he would play for, he'd captain coach Warratnabil on a Wednesday, and then he'd go down and play for Richmond or St Kilda on the Saturday. By the time Cazaly went to Minyip, that switched to a Saturday comp. But as I said, there was good money on offer, and he was lured there, and there were 60-something applicants for the job, and I think it was £12 or £13 a week, with the promise of a job on the side.
Yeah, and
so I think he would have taken it, and also too, knowing that the Swans were happy enough for him to go because he'd given them good service. He wasn't going to a rival of theirs.
Yeah.
It wasn't like he was going to play for, you know, Collingwood or something. And also, I guess the understanding would have been that he could always come back in a year or two if he wanted to.
Yeah.
So the funny thing is the club were happy for him to go, but the VFL weren't all that happy for him to be transferred. But when they were told by the club at the hearing, well, he's already got a job lined up.
Yeah, he's gone.
In fact, he's actually already gone this morning. They went, grudgingly, they said, oh, okay, well, I guess we'll let him go. So he played footy that year. He ran this store over summer, and he played cricket very successfully for the district. And he played in a, I don't know, I'm sure they don't do it now, but they used to have a thing called Country Week, where all the best district cricket sides would come from the country and play a sort of round robin series. And I think from memory, they came second that year.
Oh, wow.
And they played the final at the G. Schmidt was in the side as well. He was part of the Wimmera side. They had a very successful week. But back in Minyip, he didn't have a very successful year, both on or off the field. On the field, there were a lot of issues with, I think, from what I can tell, rivalries within the team.
Yep.
There seemed to be two different camps, one that was sort of coalesced around the former captain, Ted Power, and one that formed around Roy himself. They didn't have a very successful season. For whatever reason, his store went bust as well. So round about the time they were looking to rehire him, the club was also saying, well, we can't afford to pay what we've been paying previously. Maybe the wheat prices slumped.
Yeah.
But they still wanted him. They still said he was the man to have at the right price. But within a week, his wife had taken the kids out of school, and he was back training at the Lake Oval to resume with South Melbourne. So, and there was a creditors meeting that was held a couple of months later in Warratnabil, and I haven't been able to find the records of that, the result of that meeting, and so I don't know the whys and why-fors of why he went bust. I can only assume it could have been one of a number of factors. I know he was never big on running the books.
Yeah.
His wife, Gould, was. Aggie was very good at running books, but I think she would have been busy with the kids. Maybe he left the store in charge of somebody else while he was off playing cricket over the summer, and they didn't do well. Maybe some of his some of the bigger customers reneged on debts. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's all, you know, it's almost 100 years ago.
Yeah, it's 100 years ago.
Good point.
You know, all I know is that was the end result, and he ended up going back to Melbourne.
Yeah.
So one of those rare failures, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
In his life, but I'm sure he learnt from them. He seems to have learnt from those things and picked himself up. The interesting thing is, there were other times in his career where he seems to have gone to ground a bit. You know, after a disappointing season, for example, and. At the end of the 42 season at Hawthorn, the committee wanted to reappoint him, but the secretary couldn't get in touch with him. He called on him a couple of times to see him at their house, and he was told, no, he's sick and so on.
Yeah.
And then in the new year, Roy said, oh, well, I'm back and I'm feeling better, and well, you know, I think we're going to have a good season. So I think there might have been times like that where he felt down and out. But I can only assume that he drew on his own advice that he gave to other players at that time. There was one lovely quote where he used to say to players, if you're feeling down and out, look at your opponent and see if his feet are dragging, because he might be closer to breaking than you think. You know? So just, in other words, keep plugging on.
Yeah.
push him further. Yeah.
Finally, Robert, we're about to start talking about the 1922 season. You got,
oh, yes.
Any anecdotes about Cazaly from that year?
Well, you know, it wasn't his best season. He'd had a great breakout season the year before with South Melbourne, and of course the ruck combo with Flyder and Tandy was still going strong. And the club asked for who wanted to be coach, and he put his hand up and they selected him as coach. So he was captain coach. But in those first that first half of the season, they really had a shocker. I think they only won a couple of games. And at the end of, I think, round 9 or round 10, he decided he'd had enough. He decided to take personal responsibility, and he resigned. Yeah. And he made it clear to the committee. He said, look, I'm standing down as captain and coach, but I still want to be involved. I still want to be involved around the club, and I'll play as well as I can. And they accepted it. The committee actually discussed it and thought for a while about refusing to accept it, but I don't think that would have worked very well. So Tandy became acting captain and I think coach for the rest of the year. And it's funny, you know, I've read different reports that Cazaly was sacked by South that season. Well, he wasn't. He quit, and he quit of his own volition.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is, relieved of the burden of the captaincy, he actually improve on the field himself, and he actually had a very good season. I think he won another Sporting Globe, essentially a best and fairest, as voted by the public.
Yep.
He had a breakout year. He played for Victoria against South Australia in a couple of games. Had a very good season personally, but the team didn't, and the team didn't do any better under Tandy than they had under him.
No.
So I can only assume that it might have been a bit early. It was his first go as coach of a senior side, a VFL side, and maybe it was just the responsibility was a bit much. He was maybe not quite ready for it. And I'm sure he would have learned from that season and applied it in future years.
Fantastic. Well, we might wrap it up there, Robert. You've really gone in depth there on the Cazaly stuff. It'll be great for our listeners to hear about that.
Sure.
And any of our listeners out there who haven't read Cazaly the Legend, it's a really good read.
That's fantastic.
And there's much, thanks, much guys. More to it than just what Robert's spoken about today.
Yes, and you mentioned about the footnotes. I was very insistent about those.
Yes. Yeah.
I think it's important to show you, a bit like doing a maths exam back.
Yeah, show your workings.
Show your workings. You know? unfortunately, some people just write stuff and they never tell you where they got the information from.
Yeah.
And sometimes it just gets passed on and on and on, you know, as received wisdom, and it might not be quite right. And I decided early on with Cazaly that the story was big enough and interesting enough without having to embellish.
Yeah, exactly.
So I insisted on the footnotes, and I did insist on an index, even though my publisher said, Jeff said, we haven't budgeted for someone to do the index. So I said, I'll do the index. So once we had the final copy and I knew that pagination wasn't going to change, I just spent a weekend compiling an index. Because I figured anyone, even if they just got mentioned once or even if they just got played one game, they deserve to be noted.
Absolutely.
And if you're looking for your great Uncle Henry or whatever.
Yeah, you want to be able to find him.
You go to the index. Yeah, there he is. You know? So I was very insistent on that as well. But Jeff was very, very patient with me throughout. And the funny thing is that we launched it at the G, and most of his speech, Jeff actually just read out excerpts from my emails over the years where I was explaining why I hadn't quite come in on time with this next chapter.
It was a roast.
It was a nice job. It was a real acid job, but it was pretty funny. In retrospect, so I'm glad we got there in the end.
Oh yeah, well so are we. Because I've absolutely loved reading it. I've been
I'm pleased.
Enjoying.
I'm pleased. And certainly if people want to get it, Slattery, you can get it at most good bookshops still.
Yep,
I think.
Yep.
But if they're not sure, just go to the Slattery Media website. There's a page about the book there, which has a lot of excerpts. It has reviews, interviews. That sort of stuff.
Yeah,
people are still reviewing it. It got a review the other day in the, what was it, the Royal Victorian Historical Society.
Oh, fantastic.
Gave it a nice plug. So yeah, people are still, oh, the Victorian Historical Journal, here it is. So people are still discovering it. And
awesome, we might put a link on
it. I think the plan is we're going to early this year write to secondary schools in Victoria and Tassie. We're just going to email them and offer them a copy for their library.
Oh, nice.
Oh, fantastic.
And we'll try and tie it in with the existing syllabus.
Okay.
There's lots of ways you can cut this, of course, in terms of social, sporting, economic history. So yeah. We're just going to pull out a few factors that might align with the existing curricula for secondary students. And then that might jag a few more copies that way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so why not, you know? Might as well try it. Because I think we're well into the... I think the print run was 3,000. I think we're well into 2,000 something or other at the moment. So it'd be
fantastic.
Nice to
get another one.
Shift a few more. Yeah.
Awesome. All right, Robert, we appreciate you being on our podcast and sharing your knowledge of Cazalia. It'll be very helpful for our listeners and for us going forward talking about the early 1920s in football. But we appreciate you giving up your time.
No, it's been a pleasure. Thanks very much for having me on, guys.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can contact Kick to Kick by email at kicktokickpodcast@gmail.com. Find us on Twitter at kicktokickpod or Instagram, which is at kicktokickpod as well. For our growing list of all our references, please go to kicktokick.podbean.com/p/reference-list. Thank you very much for listening.